The question presented in this appeal is whether the defendant's failure to accommodate the plaintiff's otherwise known physical disabilities and impairments constitutes a material adverse action within the Burlington Northern analysis of the Supreme Court. That analysis is one of retaliation. The second issue is whether that failure to accommodate can rise to the level as to render a person with a transitory issue, in fact, disabled within the meaning of the Act due to that failure to accommodate. In the instant case, Your Honors, the plaintiff's treating physicians advised the agency on no fewer than four separate occasions that she had serious physical limitations following foot surgery. These recommendations traversed.
Did it rise, in your opinion, to the, I'm not going to ask you to forsake your client in the middle, that she was disabled, sufficient to establish her disability?
Yeah. Your Honor, I believe that the plaintiff was able to handle her physical disabilities with respect to her hammer toes quite ably before her surgery. Her disability claim arises straightforward
to
the court after the failure to accommodate. Before the failure to accommodate, she was not disabled.
Okay.
All right. And the request for accommodations traversed April through June. These requests for accommodation were specific, the first of which is that she be limited to a 4 to 6 hour workday, that the edema on her surgical site became so inflamed that they requested she have a very severe limitation regarding her ambulation and walking at the job, and that standing and the like be severely curtailed in her job duties.
Now, let me make sure I have the sequence of this right. Following the medical leave, she got to work, and she worked 4 to 6 hours a day with breaks, and she was scheduled for 6-hour shifts in the first week to accommodate her based on what the doctor had said and to take breaks within her discretion.
Yes, sir.
And then after that, she was authorized to go back to work full time.
Correct.
Right, there was no doctor's note or anything that said that she couldn't work 8 hours a day.
Yes, Your Honor, there was. In fact, she was released to work after that surgery for 4 to 6 hours, but after her second week of return to duty, she was assigned an 8-hour day.
Right.
The record, in fact, shows that she was only released back full-time on June 23rd. The agency required her to work 8 hours, however, as early as April. Now, the plaintiff, because of these ailments, and in this case post-surgical edema, asked for a leave without pay. That had been granted earlier. After the surgery, the employer admits that leave without pay was feasible, but it was denied. She asked not to work 8 hours. That was denied. In fact, the plaintiff was advised if she didn't work 8 hours, she would either lose her benefits or be subject to termination. When they moved the plaintiff...
And so did she bring in a doctor's note to that effect?
Four of them, Judge. April 7th, 2008, April 21st, 2008, May 29th, 2008, and June 23, 2008. Defendants stipulated... They received all of these.
Counsel, I'm having some difficulty figuring out what kind of argument you're making. It has been a moving target, both in the district court and here, based on what I read in your briefs and what I'm hearing you say now. Your briefs didn't challenge the district court's decision to the extent that the court concluded that she didn't have an actual disability, and so there was no discrimination by failure to accommodate kind of violation here. Your briefs argued that the agency improperly regarded her as having a disability, even though she didn't have one. So you tried to recast the claim as a regarded as claim on appeal, which is different from what I'm hearing you argue now. So I'm just concerned about some waiver issues here.
Okay. In fact, the complainant did raise a regarded as claim, and the facts that she relied upon was that she was advised that she was subject only to light duty, that they feigned in an argument to her they were giving her light duty, and in fact, in addition to that, they perceived her to be unable to do her full-time duties by virtue of the 4 to 6 hour start. So there was no question, in at least the defendant's mind, that she was unable to perform substantial job duties that she would normally do.
So now you are advancing a regarded as claim, not a claim that she was actually disabled and required an accommodation and that the agency therefore violated her rights under the Act.
Both, Your Honor. She was perceived, but more importantly for our argument today, this failure to accommodate in fact rendered her disabled.
So but it's the problem is you didn't raise that argument on appeal. You focused on this regarded as claim.
Only because the district court decision indicates that she was limited in her request for relief, having never raised a regarded as claim. In fact, she did raise, both in the complaint itself and in the depositions and the like, that regarded as claim was never jettisoned or waived.
Right, but if you didn't develop an argument on this alternative theory of the case in your appellate briefing, then that's gone. You can't develop it from the podium during oral argument.
The failure to accommodate claim has always been the principal claim of the plaintiff.
Well, maybe so, but that wasn't the focus of your briefing. Your briefing.
The reply brief very clearly
but you
is
can't,
devoted
you can't
to
it. Raise an argument for the first time in a reply brief. That's
I would
a
respectfully
waiver.
Suggest to the court it's never been waived by the plaintiff, and it is both in the opening brief, in the summary judgment proceedings below, as well as the reply brief.
No, I think it was preserved in the district court. I question whether it was raised properly on appeal or whether we're limited to this regarded as claim, which is was the focus, as I read your briefs, of your appeal.
A legal question I would leave to the court.
Where is the evidence that either Sipple or Hardesty harbored any animus against Kurowski for requesting accommodations?
I believe this indicate is found clearly in the ridiculing of the plaintiff
that,
for
that
these
Charlie
requests.
Chaplin remark? Is that what
one of the remarks, but more importantly, I think the most important issue that I saw in the facts was when the plaintiff submitted all these medical documents. And in the Hardesty deposition, incredibly, he says, and I quote, I don't have a single piece of paper to tell me what your limitations are. And the interactive process under the ADA, one of the fundamental requirements of an employer, is to look at the limitations, try to fashion some type of work environment that's workable. And in this case, astoundingly, there is two quotes by her direct supervisor, Mr. Hardesty, I don't have any idea what's wrong with you, madam. You're supposed to do the job, whether it's 8 hours, full-time, or otherwise. You don't have any limitations that I'm aware of. And this stands the good faith interactive process virtually on its head. And these were direct quotes from her supervisor, Mr. Hardesty. These limitations were, in effect, never communicated from Mr. Sipple, the second-line supervisor, to Mr. Hardesty, the first-line supervisor. And
you're down to your last minute, you know.
Pardon me, Your Honor.
You're down to your last minute. You want to save a minute for a rebuttal?
Yes, I would.
All right.
Thank you, Judge.
Thank you.
Mr. Cook?
May it please the Court? Counsel, Ms. Kurowski was termination was the result of a long record of absenteeism that began before she ever asked for an accommodation. The VA's latest warning to her about her absenteeism came just 1 month before her foot surgery, and in that warning, her supervisor Jim Sipple told told her that if she missed work again, she could be marked AWOL and disciplined. She had already been disciplined with a suspension from work before that. Latest warning is in December of 2007. Then she has her foot surgery, and her 1 month of FMLA leave ends, and she simply chooses not to come back to work. Her supervisor has to call her, has to send a letter to her to find out when she's coming back. She calls him in response and says, I'll be back in April. She comes back in April. She's back at work for a couple more months, and then in June, she decides that she doesn't want to come into work on another instance. And in that occasion, the reason she gives the VA for missing work has nothing to do with her physical condition. She says that her screen door on her balcony has come off its track, that her glass door next to the screen door has a broken lock, that there are workers tuck-pointing the building at the level of her condo, that she feels a need to protect her condo from intrusion by these workers. That excuse wasn't satisfactory to John Hardesty. He told her it didn't excuse her absence from work, and they decided to mark her AWOL. Later, Jim Sipple recommended her termination to Neil Toyne, and Neil Toyne was actually the person who took the decision to terminate her employment at the VA. Ms. Kurowski argues here before this court that she was fired because she asked for accommodations, but she conceded in her brief that there's no evidence that Neil Toyne, the decision maker, even knew that she had ever asked for an accommodation. Without any evidence that Toyne knew that she had exercised a protected activity, her retaliation claim had to fail.
And these various dates that counsel referred to where medical documents were submitted, I'm not seeing that in the briefs or in the district court's underlying opinion. Were there doctor's notes? He said there was a stipulation.
There were doctor's notes, Your Honor. The first doctor's note, she provided in mid-April.
Right.
I think it was April 7th, as counsel for Ms. Kurowski said, saying that Ms. Kurowski can come back to work. I prefer that she have a shift 4 or 6 hours with opportunities to ice her leg or rest her leg. She was given a six-hour shift and was given a seat right next to her workstation and told she could take breaks whenever she wants. 1 week later, this is the note dated April 21st, her same doctor says she's released to return to work is the language of the note. I'd still prefer that she have a seat near her workstation. And it was at that point that she returned to an eight-hour shift still in the retail store. The retail store had this situation where she couldn't have a seat at her cash register. It was right outside the retail store. So Sipple, her supervisor, said, would you be interested in going to the food court? There would be a seat right at your register. She agreed to that accommodation, and she moved over to the food court and worked at a register. In late May, after she had already been in the food court for 1 month with that arrangement, she had a third note from her doctor saying, I just want Ms. Kurowski to continue to have light duty with limited ambulation, essentially affirming the arrangement that she had had for the previous month. The last note was in the end of June after she'd already been marked AWOL, after James Sipple had already recommended her termination, essentially saying, well, now she's actually okay to go back to work full time. After all of the key events and decisions had been made. Your Honors, the district court was right to dismiss the retaliation claim because for multiple reasons, but also because there was no evidence whatsoever in the record that the decision maker, Neil Toyne, even knew that she had requested an accommodation. And I would also add, Your Honors, that any argument about Ms. Kurowski's status under the Rehabilitation Act has been waived or forfeited. She argued below that she was actually disabled. The district court disagreed, She came to this court, didn't argue that she was actually disabled, now argued that she was regarded as disabled. It's waived because she didn't argue it to the district court, and she claims that she did, but all she did was mention it in her complaint. In fact, the VA argued in its summary judgment motion that there wasn't evidence sufficient to find that she was regarded as disabled. She ignored that argument. If there are no further questions, I'd ask that the district court's decision be affirmed.
Thank you, Mr. Cook. How much time? 1 minute.
Your Honor, with respect to the termination action on the AWOL for the date in question, there are three reasons I want to bring to the court's attention that this is pretextual. First, her supervisor on that date, in their telephone call, my client called in advance of the shift. He said, quote, do what you have to do in the circumstances you face with respect to your security at your apartment. She testified that that's what she was told. Mr. Hardesty admitted that's what he told her, and she was not subject to any discipline for over a week after that period. Further, the evidence shows my client had a leave balance of 50 hours. And finally, the so-called argument that this is progressive in discipline that the court should accept. The deposition testimony establishes from Mr. Sippel that the plaintiff had always, for the year preceding this incident, provided medical verifications and sufficient evidence for each and every absence for a year prior to that instance on June 16th.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Bridge.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, court.
The case will be taken under advisement.